This is The Takeaway. My name is Matt Katz, and I'm filling in for Tanzina Vega all this week. When a person with diabetes goes to prison, they'll probably get the insulin they need to stay alive. When someone with an opioid addiction goes to prison, the chances they'll get medication to help is slim. This is a crisis that affects people from all incomes, all races, and in all parts of the country. And you, our listeners, have stories to share of incarceration and addiction.
Greg calling from Chicago, Illinois, and I wanted to comment regarding a personal friend who was addicted to opioids and was arrested for possession of a controlled substance and incarcerated for several months by the Cook County Department of Corrections. At the time of her incarceration, no treatment options were afforded to her. She was forced to withdraw from her substance addiction cold turkey, so to speak. Upon release several months later, no treatment programs were offered, and she returned to her old habits and continues to abuse opioid narcotics today.
My name is Donna. My brother was incarcerated, and he was also addicted to opioids. He managed to deal with the side effects, diarrhea, sneezing, and flu-like symptoms. He didn't ask for help, and none was offered when he was incarcerated, and he did know what to expect. He turned to alcohol and found opioids again not long after he got out. There wasn't any support system, nothing to turn to, and nothing set up after being released.
And sometimes, no treatment can be a death sentence.
When you compare to the general population, an inmate just out of prison during the first few weeks can be more than 100 times more likely to overdose than somebody in the general population. So that makes this moment when somebody is just coming out of prison as some of the riskiest in any place in the world, at any time in the world, for an opioid overdose.
Today on The Takeaway, we begin with one piece of the opioid epidemic that often stays hidden from public view, how addiction is treated in prisons. Herman Lopez, who you just heard, is a senior reporter for Vox, and he says the experiences that our listeners shared are pretty much the norm.
What typically happens is they kind of have to tough it out for themselves. This is what you generally hear across prisons in the country, is just a lot of inmates can't get a good addiction treatment, or any addiction treatment for that matter. That can mean going through withdrawal by themselves, and this withdrawal can be pretty grueling. I mean, if somebody can imagine the worst flu they've ever had, couple that with the worst anxiety they've ever had, you start getting an idea of just how bad withdrawal is. This is a serious problem. It hurts a lot, and without the proper treatment, an inmate can not only be hurt by this and suffer because of it, but with some drugs, it can be fatal.
And give us a point of comparison. How does this experience in prison differ from what a treatment facility might do for someone with addiction to opioids?
So yeah, if you go into like the top line best addiction treatment facilities in the country right now, typically what would happen is you would be prescribed one of three medications. They are buprenorphine, methadone, or naltrexone. These are considered the gold standard treatment for opioid addiction. They all work in different ways, but essentially what they do is reduce cravings for opioids. And in the case of methadone and buprenorphine, they also mitigate withdrawal symptoms. Mm. So that's really important, because one reason that people continue using opioids is because they want to avoid withdrawal. So buprenorphine and methadone help with that by essentially making sure that these people never had to go through crippling full withdrawal. These medications, to just emphasize this, mm-hmm. these medications are proven. Like they have a lot of evidence behind them, decades of evidence behind them. They reduce the mortality rate among opioid addiction patients by half or more, depending on the study that you look at. So these are pretty good treatment interventions. But in prisons, they're not used very often.
Right. It's medicine for these people. And that's why some experts have likened most prisons' approach to an inmate and not providing them these drugs as like not giving insulin to a patient with diabetes. What do you make of that comparison?
I think based on the research I've read and the experts I talked to, that seems exactly right. One of the things with these medications is that it's not even just that they stop withdrawal and stop cravings, but they also build your tolerance towards opioids in the case of methadone and buprenorphine because they are actually opioids themselves. Mm-hmm. So let's say somebody goes to prison, they spend a few months or years there. If they don't get on buprenorphine or methadone, they're going to lose their tolerance to opioids. And that means that when they get out of prison, if they try to use the same dose that they used before they were in prison, they're much more likely to die, right? Because suddenly they'll be taking a dose that they're simply not used to anymore. What buprenorphine and methadone do is help build this protective effect, essentially, where somebody who's taking buprenorphine and methadone, if they do happen to relapse once they get out of prison, which is obviously not something that you want in treatment, but it's something that can happen, then they're going to be much less likely to overdose and die. Mm. And so that's another benefit of these drugs. It's not just that they stop the cravings and the withdrawal. It's that they can potentially mitigate the risk of overdose.
Germán López of Vox is with me. We're looking at how prisons in the U.S. treat opioid addiction, or as the case may be, don't treat opioid addiction. Germán, you did find at least one state that's offering gold standard treatments, as they're known. Tell us about that.
Right now, the only state in the country that offers all three forms of medications for opioid addiction is Rhode Island. And some states have moved in this direction, Vermont in particular, but if you go to, like, talk to prisoners on the ground there, they're still having a lot of trouble accessing this medication. So what Rhode Island did is it basically said, okay, we're going to make these medications available in our prisons and jails, which the state could do because it actually controls both in Rhode Island. And as a result, that this just massively increased the availability of these medications. The one study that has come out of this Rhode Island experiment so far is that, yes, it does save lives. You look at the amount of people who come out of prison and are suffering overdoses, and they do seem to have come down more than the rest of the state's overdoses have since they started this intervention.
So if we know this works and we have data to indicate it works, why haven't more prisons and states adopted this approach? Is it about money? Is it about the culture? Why hasn't it happened yet?
I think it's a mix, but mostly about the culture. So sure, there is some like financial concerns, like offering any medical services will obviously cost these prisons more than offering no medical services in this area. So that's obviously one thing. But the biggest thing seems to be culture, in that there have been surveys done of correctional facilities and correctional officials. And what they find is that they often still view addiction not as a health problem. They view it as a criminal or moral failure. And when you approach addiction like that, you're much less likely to say, obviously, that these inmates need medication for their opioid addiction. Mm-hmm. So that's essentially what's happening, is that there's a lot of resistance in these prisons and these jails to giving inmates medication because a lot of people just don't view this as a health problem. The other thing is that there are some concerns that buprenorphine in particular can be diverted for misuse. Since it is an opioid, there is a risk that it can be diverted for misuse. The one thing with buprenorphine, though, is that it actually has a ceiling on its effect, so it's much more difficult to get high on it, especially if you build tolerance to opioids over the years. You're just not going to get the same euphoric high you get from heroin or fentanyl. Like, that's just not going to happen. But there is a risk that some diversion, meaning like the people will sell it to other inmates, and that could cause problems. But the way that Rhode Island has gotten around this is that it makes sure that people, when they get their buprenorphine dose on the spot, that they actually consume it, that they fully dissolve the tablet or the strip in their mouths, and then they can leave, right? And it's the same thing with methadone. They make sure that they like drink their methadone, and then they can leave. And that's essentially what's happening. That's essentially what Rhode Island has done to get around this diversion issue. So there are ways around these problems, but the biggest one seems to be this cultural barrier, this stigma barrier. Mm-hmm. And getting around that is really a matter of just educating prison officials on the efficacy of these drugs.
And there's a parallel issue here, I imagine, and that's the criminalization of nonviolent drug users and whether nonviolent drug users should be in jail and in prison in general.
Yeah, that's totally right. I mean, one question is, like, should somebody who has an addiction and might have been, whether it's that they're in prison because of their actual drug possession or something along those lines, or whether they're in prison because they robbed a place because of their drug use. I mean, the question is the right intervention for those people actually putting them in prison, or is it getting them help for their addiction? Now, the reality is that we are locking up a lot of people who have a drug addiction. So now that we have that reality, prison should be offering this treatment. But there is definitely a question of over whether these people should be in prison in the first place, or whether society would be better served and like combating crime would be better done by getting these people treatment before they end up in a prison.
Now, in the scheme, though, of the larger, broader opioid crisis, how significant do you see this particular problem involving jails and prisons? Are the prisons fueling the opioid epidemic, or is this just, you know, one piece of the larger problem?
I mean, it's certainly one piece of the larger problem, but it is a big piece. That I think that's important to emphasize. Like, if you look at these studies and look at the risk that these inmates face when they're released from prison and how they're massively at risk for overdose, this is a large population that's at risk, that's misusing drugs, that might be addicted to drugs, and they need help. So just anything that you can do there to reduce that problem will inevitably save lives, and by saving lives, you do mitigate the opioid epidemic.
Germán López is a senior reporter for Vox. Germán, great to talk to you. Thank you for your reporting.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me again.
This is Candy. I'm calling from Lillington, Michigan. Has someone you know been incarcerated while addicted to opioids? The answer to that is yes. Second question, was treatment available in prison? Answer, you have got to be kidding me, unless you think we're in Scandinavia. Third question, did they overcome the addiction? Hard to say.
My name is Eric Murray, calling from Carlsbad, California. My uncle was an addict of heroin and different opiates, went into county jail, was put on methadone, received treatment, did not dry up, is still on methadone more than 10 years later.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth. I'm calling from New York City. Yes, my nephew became addicted to OxyContin in the military following an on-duty accident. After his medical discharge, he became addicted to heroin, which was cheaper and easier to get. The VA was no help whatsoever. I paid out of pocket about $55,000 for a month-long inpatient detox and rehab, after which he was in two different sober living houses for about 6 weeks, but he got kicked out. He relapsed and almost died from an overdose and then went back into rehab but checked out early. He died a couple of weeks later on April 4th of this year from an overdose of heroin laced with fentanyl and other things.
Difficult and important stories from our listeners about this topic of addiction and incarceration. Thank you so much for sharing them with us. And we're continuing with our top story today, how prisons are handling the opioid crisis. Reporter Germán López just told us that Rhode Island is working to address criminality and drug addiction at the same time, and officials are taking a similar approach in the Garden State. In New Jersey, more than 8 people die from drug overdoses every day, with nearly 1,700 dead from an overdose so far in 2018. So, last spring, the state opened an entire prison dedicated to treating inmates with addictions. Marcus O. Hicks is the acting commissioner of the New Jersey Department of Corrections, and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Acting Commissioner Hicks.
Thank you, Matt, for having me.
Absolutely. So, what is motivating this move to treat incarcerated individuals as patients who need medical assistance?
Well, you know, Matt, this is an issue that not only affects the community, the greater community in New Jersey, but also affects the incarcerated population. To give you context, about 30% of our incoming incarcerated individuals out of 10,000 have a substance use disorder diagnosis. So we're seeing an increasing need for treatment. It caused us to address this at a higher level. And New Jersey happens to be one of the leaders in moving forward with this population. So we're doing a lot of good things. One of it was opening Mid-State Correctional Facility in April of 2017 to be a state-licensed treatment center for incarcerated folks.
So is every individual, every person at Mid-State Correctional Facility opioid addicted or addicted to some other drug?
Yes. So it's fully substance use disorder. So all the inmates that are referred to Mid-State have some sort of treatment needs. We have 700 beds for males. We also have a similar program for our women population at our women's facility. And it offers licensed treatment, whether it's intensive outpatient, outpatient, short-term and long-term residential care, what you would receive in the community. We actually offer that behind the walls in our prison setting, and it's been, so far, it's proven to be very effective.
What analysis have you been able to do to indicate that it's been successful so far?
So preliminarily, we've had about 118 people that have been released from prison. And out of that 118 people, only 8 of them have returned back to prison. So in terms of recidivism, which we tend to measure in the corrections industry, it's proven highly effective. On top of that, just from talking to our incarcerated population that are in the program, they report optimism. They are feeling better. The health is better. So we have every reason to continue this program and to expand upon it.
Do you hope to track some of the people after they leave prison to see if they're staying off the drugs?
Absolutely. And so the data moving forward is going to be very important for us. One of the things that we have done in New Jersey is that we have implemented a reentry navigator program, which basically pairs people with individuals who are receiving treatment in the pre-release phase. So they're about to be released. We follow them a year post-release because, as you know, that critical time period is that initial 30 days after their release. So their job is to follow up with them to make sure that their treatment needs are continuing to be addressed. And we're going to have data to show that that's been effective.
So you have this special facility for those who are addicted to opioids. What about for other inmates in the state, whether they're at other prisons or county jails?
Yes. So we are fortunate in New Jersey to offer substance use disorder treatment to all of our inmate population, not just at that one facility. So regardless of where you are allowed to take part in treatment. And we also offer medication-assisted treatment to anyone who needs it. So that's statewide.
Herman Lopez, the reporter from Vox, who we spoke with earlier, he talked about the culture inside corrections that has made this difficult to pull off in some states. And I'm wondering if that's something you can speak to. Has there been any resistance to this internally, the idea of treating addiction as a public health crisis within incarcerated settings?
Yeah, the culture, that's a very critical point. And that's something that we had to deal with in New Jersey. The way that we dealt with it is that we offer training to our correctional police officers because, again, many of them grew up in a time where the correction management practice was to lock them up and throw away the key.
Exactly, yeah.
And we have shifted that. And that philosophy has changed. So part of that came with educating our officers. So we offered training to them to look at, you know, substance use disorder, how to deal with inmates who have this and who are locked up because of that. That proved to be effective. We've also equipped them with Narcan. So that's actually a tool that they now use. That's something new that they didn't have to deal with before. So the philosophy and the culture has changed, but it does take education. And I think that nationwide, this is something that you're going to see more correctional departments move forward with.
Do you think handling the opioid crisis in this way potentially opens inroads for corrections departments to maybe better handle mental health problems in general inside prisons and jails?
Absolutely. A large portion of our population have co-occurring disorders, meaning they come in with substance use disorder diagnoses, as well as mental health issues. And in New Jersey, our aim is to rehabilitate the entire person. So that means that we have to address the mental health issues. We have to address the substance use disorder issues. We have to address medical issues. But the end of the day, the goal is to protect the public, enhance public safety by trying to reduce recidivism. If that means that we have to give someone treatment on their mental health addiction as well, or mental health challenges, as well as a substance use addiction, then that's what we have to do to make all of us safer.
And real quick, can you just tell me where the funding for these programs are coming from?
Yeah, so Governor Murphy has been very proactive in New Jersey with addressing this issue. He has provided $100 million statewide to address the opioid crisis, and a portion of which comes to the Department of Corrections. So it definitely takes a high-level commitment. It's helpful that we have a governor that recognizes this as a public health epidemic and also in the context of corrections, a public safety issue. And so he has dedicated that funding to us, and then we have moving forward with programs to address the issue further.
Thank you so much. Marcus O. Hicks is Acting Commissioner of the New Jersey Department of Corrections. Acting Commissioner, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Matt.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Today marks the end of the third and final bailout for Greece. The Greek economy is growing today, but 8 years of financial crisis and austerity have left the nation in a very difficult place. Liz Alderman is the chief European business correspondent for the New York Times, and she's currently in Greece covering the story. Liz, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
So remind us, why did Greece need these bailouts in the first place, and what did they end up meaning for the country?
Well, Greece, as y'all may recall, kind of became the epicenter of Europe's debt crisis back in 2010. That was shortly after Wall Street blew up and Lehman Brothers fell. The global financial markets were still reeling at that time, and Greece decided to come out and announce that it had actually been significantly understating its deficit figures for years. That raised a lot of alarm bells about the soundness of Greek finances. And while Greece is a very small country, at that time, there were a number of other countries within the Euro currency union that had also started to become very shaky, including Ireland and Portugal. Greece wound up having sort of an outsized impact because it had a very large debt to begin with. And basically, creditors, which included the International Monetary Fund, the European Commission, and the European Central Bank, swooped in with a kind of a massive rescue package to stabilize Greece, along with the other countries, in a bid to keep the Euro Union from breaking up, which it looked like might possibly happen. And things actually just got worse from there, because the austerity that was imposed as conditions for receiving that money wound up making the economic conditions in Greece and those other countries worse, not better.
Is this the end of austerity measures in Greece? Is this what this means today?
It actually does not mean the end of austerity measures. Greece wound up being on these so-called bailouts much longer than any of the other countries because its finances were much worse off. It had really mismanaged its finances. And in addition, just like with the other countries, you had a large number of European banks, specifically German and French, Italian banks, who had bought up a lot of Greek debt, to which pretty much most of this bailout money has gone to try and keep those banks from going under, as well as going back to the creditors. But even though Greece is getting off of that today, the austerity conditions will remain. In fact, Greece is going to remain under so-called surveillance from its creditors for at least the next 4 years. They're going to be watching to make sure that Greece continues to keep that belt tightened so that it can look better in the eyes of international financial markets and hopefully lure more banks and more investors to come back to the country at some point and start buying up Greek debt again.
Now, the good news is that the economy in Greece has actually grown for the last 5 quarters and unemployment is on the decline. How does that fit into the larger picture here?
Well, the economy started to stabilize recently, really in the middle of last year, after this very chaotic episode, really just 3 years ago, in which Greece nearly came spinning out of the Euro currency union. That was shortly after the current prime minister, Alexis Tsipras, was elected. He promised the Greeks that he would reverse the austerity conditions under the bailout. He turned around and did the exact opposite. He accepted another bailout as well as harsh austerity conditions. And so that caused the economy to sort of relapse quite badly for a while. But since the last year and a half or so, things have sort of stabilized. And that has actually kind of helped a mild recovery take hold. The mild recovery, we've seen a lot of tourism, for example, coming to Greece. Some investors starting to take a look at whether it makes sense to invest here again. And also Greek businesses, which have actually increased a lot of their exports because the Greek domestic market isn't really doing so well still. So with that stability, you know, they're hoping that there will be kind of a positive upward effect taking hold. That being said, there are still plenty of challenges because the quality of the recovery is extremely uneven, as are the type of jobs that are being created along with this recovery.
You're in Greece and you've been talking to Greeks about the end of these bailouts. What have they been telling you? Do they see this as a big moment for the country?
Really, actually, most Greeks that I talk to are sort of very resigned about the situation. Many Greeks basically say that although it's supposed to be kind of a significant day symbolically, the end of the bailouts don't really mean anything to them because their lives have been impacted very severely. In a story that I had in the New York Times today, where I spoke with a number of Greek people for a reportage on basically the fact that, you know, poverty has increased quite significantly during the last 8 years. Around 30% of the population is considered to be at or around the poverty line. A number of Greeks have difficulty making ends meet. A lot of the jobs, as I mentioned, that are being created are actually quite precarious in nature, short-term or temporary jobs, minimum wage, which was cut significantly, or many people working really not with contracts at all. So for people who have been kind of, you know, hammered by very deep, you know, austerity and economic contraction, what those people say is for them, they still don't see a light at the end of the tunnel. On the other hand, you do have a number of businesses that, because the situation is stabilizing, they are starting to see, for example, an increase in orders. A number of businesses that I talked to have actually started hiring again. And we're also seeing an interesting amount of startup activity happening here. The question is, you know, how sustainable is that recovery going to be going forward?
Liz, can we zoom out for a moment and talk about the continent as a whole? Where does this leave the overall health of the Eurozone? And also, what are the larger political implications throughout Europe in the wake of all of these bailouts?
Well, the Eurozone itself has actually been recovering pretty significantly within the last couple of years from, you know, the debt crisis that affected, you know, Greece and really all of the other countries. Greece is really one of the laggards in terms of recovery, although that recovery started mild, you know, in a very mild way last summer. It's still quite far behind most of the other Eurozone countries. But as a whole, the Eurozone is doing better. You know, also, the fact of the matter is everybody's talking about Brexit,
right,
which is a far bigger menace to the European Union. That being said, you know, there are still kind of a lot of, you know, shadows in the background that could come back onto the scene and disturb things. That being, for example, the recent elections in Italy and some of the nervousness in financial markets about that, as well as what we're seeing happening in Turkey. So, you know, things are kind of seem to be stabilizing for the moment. But, you know, we need to see what the future holds.
Sure. Liz Alderman is the chief European business correspondent for the New York Times. Liz, thank you so much for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega. You want to be a good global citizen. You dutifully separate your papers and plastics, bag them up, place them on your stoop or in front of your house, and you wait, trusting that the powers that be will recycle them. But will your recycled trash really get a second life? Or will it end up in a landfill basically until the end of time? The most recent study available from the Environmental Research and Education Foundation found that up to 43% of recyclables get trashed because of contamination. That's when items that aren't recyclable end up in the bins, or when things that can be recycled are too dirty, like a greasy pizza box. Bill Moore is the president of Moore & Associates, a recycling consulting firm. And back in the 80s, Bill started the rollout of the largest recycling program across the country with Waste Management, which is still one of the biggest players in the recycling game. Bill, thanks for coming on The Takeaway.
Matt, thank you.
So, Bill, how are we doing? Are we better off or worse off than we were 10 or 15 years ago when it comes to recycling?
Well, we're kind of at a crossroads from a number of reasons. We've gotten much worse at putting the wrong things in our bin and creating contamination. And on the other side, on the demand side, China has upset the global recycling business by limiting the imports of recyclables that were going into that country.
So why are we getting worse at putting the wrong things in the bin? Do we just assume that everything is recyclable and we throw too much of our stuff in there?
That's a bit of the assumption that people make when they have a big recycling cart. We call it the wish recyclers. I wish this thing was recyclable, and it's probably not, and it winds up contaminating the good recyclables. So we think everything's recyclable, but it isn't.
And you mentioned China. China had taken a lot of our recyclables for years, and now they're going to be more selective. What's happening with everything that used to go to China?
Well, some of it's being redistributed in other parts of the world. Southeast Asia, India are buyers. There is some material being landfilled and disposed of that was recyclable in the past. And finally, in the U.S., we're seeing capacity being built to consume the materials that China once took.
Huh. So why does this make sense to send recyclables to China or to Southeast Asia or all over the world? Doesn't that consume a ton of energy to just move this stuff all the way over there?
Well, actually, it kind of works the other way. In the global container shipping business, moving materials around, lots of goods come out of Asia that go to Western Europe and go to Europe and the U.S., and those containers have to go back. And if they don't go back with things like raw materials or recyclables, they go back empty.
So you started a nationwide recycling program back in the 1980s, and we're now three decades later, and we're still, you know, figuring this recycling thing out. Why is that the case? How is that possible that we haven't figured out how to recycle to near universal capacity?
Well, a couple of things. One is we've changed the approach on how we collect and sort materials. We've gotten away from good public education, and that's a piece again of getting the right thing in the recycling cart. And the markets change as we go forward, and we've added new materials along the way, and that causes confusion for the citizens who put out their recyclables, and many of them are more difficult to recycle.
Many of the biggest recycling companies also own landfills, waste management, where you worked being one of them. Are there any kinds of competing interests here that consumers should be concerned about?
Yeah, I don't see that. I don't see a conflict. Yes, the solid waste management companies of the U.S. are part of the major business of recycling, but they've invested millions and millions of dollars in it. Their customers want the service. People want to recycle. We just have to get the economics right, and we've been off a bit on the economics over the last 10 plus years.
I'm talking about the recycling industry today with Bill Moore, the president of a recycling consulting firm. Waste Management CEO James Fish, earlier this year, he announced record profits in all parts of their business except for recycling. Here he is speaking on CNBC in February.
Recycling is probably the only segment of our business that's not hitting on all 12 cylinders going into 18. And part of it is because of the contamination requirements coming from China. Contamination basically meaning that there's trash in the recycle stream. And so we've got a real battle on that at our recycle facilities.
Bill, what's your reaction to that? Is recycling less profitable than it used to be, and why?
Recycling does have some profitability problems. A big piece of it is the China pullback on the global recycled commodities, which have dropped prices for those materials throughout the world. And then the other side is we're just barely off the bottom in terms of getting our contaminant levels down into the recycling. And the new contracts coming up with cities for recycling services have higher charges because of those two things, and also built-in methods to improve the quality of what's coming into the system.
So what can be done to increase the percentage of trash that gets recycling? What kind of solutions are there in the country for dealing with these recycling woes, as they may be?
Yeah, there's a series of them. The one is getting our populace better educated on what to recycle and how to do it. And then the infrastructure that exists at the material recovery facilities is improving. We're getting better all the time with the technology that we use. We're seeing sophisticated technologies like optical sorting, and even robotics are entering the business. So we'll be able to better sort and clean up our materials.
And what can individual consumers do? I will go to a friend's house, and if I see a straw, for example, in the recycling from a Dunkin' Donuts iced coffee, I'll take the straw out and put it in the trash because you can't recycle the straw. What can the average person do if he or she wants to help increase our recycling rates?
Yeah, the first thing is to understand their recycling program and what should go in and what shouldn't. Another thing we're seeing is corrugated boxes, cardboard boxes. With the rise in e-commerce, there's a lot of boxes going to the home, and people aren't necessarily putting those out for recycling. And we really need more corrugated boxes to come back into the system.
Why aren't people putting their boxes in recycling? That seems like an obvious one. It's cardboard. It seems like obviously that's what you recycle.
Yeah, you would think that would be the case, but large boxes, people don't want to deal with them. They don't fit in their cart or their bin.
Right.
The collectors don't want to pick up large boxes.
Yeah, and you have to break down the box and fold it up if you want them to actually take it, I guess, in most circumstances.
Yeah, that's correct.
Bill Moore is the president of Moore & Associates. That's a recycling consulting firm. Thank you very much, Bill. I really appreciate you joining us.
You're welcome.
And that's it for our show today. Thank you for having me on my first day filling in for Tanzina. And listeners, do you believe your recycling is actually getting recycled? Has your city changed its recycling rules recently? Tell us on Twitter at The Takeaway or join the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina all this week. And this is The Takeaway.